You can meet and hear 12-time All-American swimmer Riley Gaines, journalist Mark and Molly Hemingway, Aaron Wren of the American Conservative, Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller of Has American Christianity Failed at the 2024 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
Previous generations, by and large, got it right, that it's about family and marriage over career and money.
Which once again just teaches us one of the major laws of these podcasts. Politics is real. Religion, religious liberty, even the First Amendment, not so real.
Anytime the screen is on, talk time between parent and child goes down by 85%. Turn off your screens. Put your phones down. The iPad is not a pacifier.
On earth as it is in heaven, we pray that every time we pray the Lord's Prayer. And I think Jesus gave us that prayer to recognize that He is the link between heaven and earth. And wherever He is, those two things are joined together.
This is John in Michigan. And as a Lutheran high school teacher, I love listening to and using Issues Etc. in my classroom.
What is the media's almost unanimous message on the subject of children and family? Children, they're a burden. Children, they sap all your energy, spend all your money, and generally get in the way of you enjoying life. Family, that's even worse. You have to sacrifice for your family. You might have to work a little less, and that, of course, would get in the way of you enjoying your wonderful life. And the message is you're better off without children. You're better off without family. Problem is, none of it's true. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live on this Wednesday afternoon, the 20th of March. We're going to talk about creating a family-friendly culture. Timothy Carney joins us. He's a married father of six children, columnist at the Washington Examiner, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and author of the new book, Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. Tim, welcome.
Thank you for having me back.
How has parenting changed in the last generation?
I think that on the practical level, it's become more intensive. The one thing I look at in Family Unfriendly is the data that, in fact, while fathers have doubled the amount of time compared to their parents or grandparents, that fathers are spending just on time with the kids, and women are working outside of the home a lot more. Women have actually increased by 50% the amount of time that they're doing just solo parenting tasks. So this includes driving the kids to a sport, helping them with homework, that sort of thing. What we've had is the local Little League, coached by volunteer parents, that's a bike ride away, has given way to the travel sports team that is intensive, expensive, and every other weekend you're at a tournament in Delaware. In addition, the idea that parents should helicopter and be there for every minute, and that kids need supervision at every minute, all of those have increased. So this is why children are more anxious, I argue. This is why parents are more stressed. And this is one reason I think that people think that it would be impossible to have more than one or two kids. And a lot of young people are starting a family.
What are the media's messages on the subject of children and family?
A lot of it is just terror, is fear-mongering. A lot of it is a prescribing something that's impossible to attain. For instance, the nationalization of the news media, the omnipresence of social media, makes some parents think that there is like a skilled kidnapper around every corner, that if you step away from your kid for a couple minutes, they're going to be nabbed and carried off. But also there's the idea that it's going to absolutely ruin your career, ruin your life. There's an op-ed in the New York Times every other week, basically, that says, getting married, having kids, absolutely ruined my life. And in addition, there's the social media comes in with some, I'm a stay-at-home mom who makes my kids grilled cheese sandwiches from scratch every morning. And by the way, I'm also a model. And this lays out this unrealistic idea of, oh, well, I guess that's what being a dedicated parent involves. And all of these things, they make parenting seem out of reach for the average American.
You talk about the culture of sterility. Describe that for us.
So I argue that the introduction of the birth control pill in the 1960s and 1970s has changed our culture more than it's changed biology. What it's done, for one thing, it's made us believe that we can, in fact, control our lives, that we can choose our child, which we don't really. Whenever you have children, no matter how planned it was, the timing, the child comes out and it's a total stranger. You've never met this person before. You didn't get to plan it. But it's also this idea that we can eliminate risk. And eliminating risk involves preserving optionality, avoiding actual deep connection. It involves trying to almost overcome our own biology. And so that idea has really, I think, poisoned the American mind, poisoned the Western mind. And it's led us to be more averse to not just parenthood, but connection in general. One reason why when the COVID lockdowns went into effect, so many of us were so quick to put on the mask and hide from other people and not even visit our parents was because somehow we had believed that the world can be made clean and free of risk. And if we just did the right thing, that's what I mean by the culture of sterility.
Does the decline of the family help explain the pervasive sadness and nihilism of our age?
I absolutely agree that the decline of family makes us sadder, and our sadness leads to less marriage and less parenthood. It's a doom loop. Not to sound too negative, but it is a feedback loop that feeds itself. That the fact is that being around kids gives us hope. I'm a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and I read through all these studies about how much more generous people are or hopeful they are when they're surrounded by or just thinking about children. And I realized I was trying to prove through social science something that's very obvious, that children represent joy and hope. And for me, we have six kids, and sometimes just walking around the neighborhood with my six kids just brings these big smiles to the face of grandparents who don't live close to their children or just neighbors, that having children around makes us happier. And that's something we sometimes forget. And so in places where there's fewer children, there's less hope for the future. And once you're not thinking a generation in the future, you start thinking just about the now, just about the present, and increasingly just about yourself. So that's why it was perfect that you use the word sadness and nihilism, because that belief in something greater, it really is driven by an idea that the future is something worth caring about.
We have been hearing a lot about young men. They used to say they were kind of perpetuating their adolescence, but it's even more toxic than that. Young men who really, you had mentioned just thinking about now, who really have no plans for the future. They're happy to extend that adolescence, give up all kinds of ambitions, and just stay where they're at and remain unmarried. Talk about that phenomenon.
It's ultimately sad. It may seem, oh, well, I have my happy hours. I have my job that's only 30 hours a week. I get to play my video games, and so I'm happy. It's ultimately sad because that's setting aside something that provides meaning for something that provides diversion. But on another level, it's kind of, I think if a lot of your listeners think about it, especially the men, when you were 21 and finishing up college or 19 and coming out of high school, if you didn't go to college, you might have landed a job that you thought, I could do this for the rest of my life. Sure, it doesn't pay a lot, but I'll just rent a small one bedroom and have enough money left over. I certainly thought about that when I was in college and right out of college. Didn't have an idea of building a life, building a family, planting myself in a community. But what happens, that natural urge in a well-functioning culture, that gets overcome. There are expectations. So in a good culture, strong culture, it's sort of expected you are going to grow up. You're going to get married and you're going to have kids. You can opt out of that if you want, but that's the normal thing. It just sort of happens. But our current culture, because we're so obsessed with autonomy, with where we think that young people are supposed to write their life script on a totally blank page with no structure to it, that leads to these young men not having the nudges towards growing up. And that's one of the reasons that we're having a decline in marriage and a decline in birth rates. And I think it's making us less happy as a society.
For parents, you had mentioned travel teams. What is what you call the travel team trap?
So when the local Little League sort of gets phased out and replaced by an intensive and expensive travel team, I think this makes most families, not all, but most families less happy. And some people choose it because they really live vicariously through their son or daughter in sports. Some parents choose because it just seems like the right thing to do. Why wouldn't I give my kids the best, including the best coach possible and the best competition? And some parents choose it just because they look and their local youth sports league is fading away because all the good pitchers are in travel ball, and baseball without a kid who can throw strikes is pretty horrible. And some fall into this trap because they just want their kid to play JV baseball, and the JV coach says, nope, you got to be playing year-round on my travel squad. And so you get trapped in this, and it can erode family culture. Again, I've talked to some parents who loved going around to the field hockey tournaments every weekend, and it became a family trip. But I've talked to more parents who said, I hate the fact that swimming dictates my family's schedule. I wish we as a parent dictated this. A lot of it is just a belief, an ambition, or a belief you're supposed to give your kids the absolute best of everything. And it leads parents to turn something that should be fun, whether it's a sport or music or dance, and make it into a job for the kids. So the kids get less unsupervised playtime, the family gets less together time, and it ends up being a trap.
Talk more about that. What was for me growing up, I'm almost 60, the norm. All my playtime was unsupervised. My mom never would have thought about walking me down to the neighbor's house for a play date. She would have said, walk yourself. And my four brothers all had the same experience growing up. How does that travel team trap replace what ought to be the spontaneity for children?
Children today are so much more scheduled than children in the past. A lot of that is due to, again, parents trying to make sure that their kids maximize their youth, maximize their development, get the right enrichment. A lot of it's just due to habit or what the rest of the culture is doing. And so what children get is if they go from school to extracurricular to homework to bed, they lose unstructured, unsupervised playtime. Now, the first thing to realize is then life is less fun. You have a less fun childhood. The other thing, and there have been multiple articles by pediatric psychologists about this, unstructured, unsupervised play is where children learn how to make up their own minds, solve problems they might encounter, be creative. You can't replace that. You can't try to structure, oh, well, I'll give them the scheduled time for creativity and solving their own problems. No, nothing replaces just setting children free. And so when we overstructure our children's lives, we deprive them of something they deserve. They deserve the time to wander the neighborhood. They deserve hours of boredom where they have to come up with their own fun. They deserve being able to make up their own mind. And we're depriving that if we're overstructuring their childhood.
How do we lower parental ambitions for our children?
So yes, chapter one, I call it Have Lower Ambitions for Your Children. And of course, this is a little tongue-in-cheek. I'm a Christian. I want my children to get into heaven. But worldly ambitions, we have to realize there's a couple of reasons to lower them. The easiest argument I make to people is what you're trying to do isn't going to work. You can't guarantee your kid is going to get into Harvard. You can't guarantee your kid is going to get a D1 scholarship. If you give him a pitching coach, private lessons, etc., some other more athletic kid is probably going to bump him out and take his place. But there's a deeper argument for it, which is to more properly align your ambitions of your children. So are they going to be loving people? Are they going to be generous adults? Are they going to be men or women of virtue? Do you tell them how important family is? and that it's more important than their career or their work? And do you show them that through their actions and how you prioritize the time that you spend as a family? That's how we lower their ambitions on the worldly things, by replacing them with more valuable ambitions.
Tim Carney is our guest, author of the new book, Family Unfriendly. When we come back, we'll talk about the culture of fear that surrounds having and raising children today. You can meet and hear 12-time All-American swimmer Riley Gaines, journalist Mark and Molly Hemingway, Aaron Wren of the American Conservative, Chris Roseborough of Fighting for the Faith, and Pastor Brian Wolfmiller of Has American Christianity Failed at the 2024 Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference. The premier conference for Christian laity is Friday, July 12th and Saturday, July 13th at Concordia University, Chicago. Learn more and register at issuesetc.org.
Join Lutherans for Life at the For Such a Time as This Lutheran Adoption Conference, April 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Enjoy the testimony and talents of Dove Award-winning musician and adoptee Mark Schultz. Discover expert information and exciting opportunities, and experience the fellowship and celebration. The 2024 Lutheran Adoption Conference, April 10th and 11th in Houston. Find out more and register at lutheransforlife.org/conferences.
Essential exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
This is Pastor Matthew Harrison, president of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. The LCMS operates the second largest parochial school system in the United States. What can you expect from a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod school? There's one race, the human race. And Jesus died for the sins of every man, woman, and child from every land and every nation. Life begins at conception. All life is precious from womb to tomb. And every student, parent, and teacher is created in the very image of God. There's right and wrong, and we know which is which from the Ten Commandments. There are only two sexes, male and female, He created them. Marriage is the lifelong union of one man and one woman. There's such a thing as objective, absolute truth, and it's found in the person and work of Jesus Christ and His Word. To find a Lutheran Church Missouri Synod school near you, visit lcms.org/schools.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about creating a family-friendly culture with Tim Carney, a columnist at the Washington Examiner and author of the new book, Family Unfriendly, How Our Culture Made Kids Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. Tim, tell us about this culture of fear that surrounds having and raising children today. We mentioned before it was one of the main themes of the media's push against family.
So some of it is this just irrational fear, this belief that there's kidnappings every day, the belief that, you know, if your kid climbs a tree, he's probably going to die. This bad risk assessment is what I call it. That actually begins before the child's ever born. The number of thou shalt nots that pregnant women get fed is endless. And it gets in the way of more valuable thou shalt nots, you know, whether they, instead of just saying, make sure you don't drink a ton, they're told any alcohol, caffeine, cold cuts, touching dirt where a cat may have walked, all of these will be horrible for your baby. And there's no such thing as a safe amount of any of this. Too much noise can be bad for them. Not getting fresh air can also be bad for them. And by the way, if you get stressed out about this, that stress is also bad for them. So that just puts parents, especially first-time parents, in this culture of fear. And that's part of the reason that parents will apply pressure to their kids, and the parents are more stressed and the children are more anxious.
That false sense of control, like you had mentioned during pregnancy, I can control this so that we have the absolute safest environment for the baby, which is not a bad impulse, but that false sense of control, does that extend then out into parenting, where it's not just trying to control for risks during pregnancy, it's trying to control for every risk during raising the child?
Yeah. So we think we can protect our kids from one in a million chances. One expert I quote said, you can't build something to protect you from getting struck by lightning. You can't prevent something absolutely horrible and unimaginable from happening to your children. And the fact is that for the most part, that sort of thing, a stranger abduction, isn't going to happen. And the one in a million chance that it does is so rare that it's hard to protect against us. And then the illusion of control also means we think we can control our children's outcomes. That should be shattered if you ever have a second kid and you realize how different the personalities are from the moment they're born. And that's how much you realize so much of this is going to be nature. So much of this is just going to be who their friends happen to be. So you can really influence your kids by trying to build around your family a community. I would use an image of a garden or an ecosystem that points them towards the good, the true, and the beautiful. But you still can't control anything. You can increase the odds, leave a bunch of good books on your shelf so that when they get bored, they pull them down. But the illusion that you can sort of mold your child like a ball of clay into the adult you want them to be and protect them from dangers, that's a harmful illusion.
You talk about the inherently isolating architecture of the suburb. What do you mean by that?
So I'm certainly not anti-suburb. I think it's one of the best places to raise children. But the American suburbs, a lot of times these days, you don't necessarily have sidewalks everywhere. If you have a giant backyard or you have an attached garage, you don't quite realize how that can isolate the nuclear family. Now, some people will use their giant backyard to constantly host all the neighborhood kids, and that's great. But if we have the central air conditioning, the windows are always down. You go from attached garage to the shopping center that's two towns away and then back. You don't have the random chance encounters with neighbors. If your kids can't run around because the roads are really wide and they're made for drivers to go 45 miles an hour, then your kids aren't having as much freedom in their childhood. So that notion of the nuclear family, a single family home, detached as a castle. In a lot of ways, that's the American dream, but in a lot of ways, it cuts against the real greatness of America, which is the neighborhoods, the communities, the bumping into your next door neighbor, your kids running around until they see another kid in the front yard. So one of the ways in which policy actually can be more family friendly is by saying, how can we build this for kids to roam the neighborhood? The sidewalks, the crosswalks, the playgrounds, the bike trails. Some neighborhoods do that. Some suburbs do that. And the parents who live there absolutely love it. And others find their kids are isolated and they have to be driven everywhere. A car-centric suburb is a family-unfriendly suburb.
What can employers do to encourage having a family?
I think employers should all start from the mindset of how can we be family friendly? Right now, employers are being encouraged to say, okay, what are we doing for the environment? What are we doing for diversity? What are we doing for equity? So that mindset, I think, needs to be, how can we help family? Because right now, America has a birth rate of about 1.6, 1.7 children per woman. But when polled, Americans say they want between 2 and 3 kids. So this is a real crisis. So employers should say, how can we address this? How can we try to help our employees have the families they want? So a big part of it for people who do have kids is flexibility. It's the ability to work from home or the ability to work 22 hours a week. So you're home at 3 o'clock every day rather than 40. A lot of it is going to be simply stating it as a priority and saying, we will accommodate your family because we think family is more important than work. I've been blessed at conservative institutions like AEI and the Washington Examiner with bosses who say that and believe that and act on that. And that would be one of the biggest things. In Family and Friendly, I have lots of little examples like owning expensive baby stuff like a snoo. A snoo is a thing they didn't have when I was having kids, but it's new now. It's this cradle that magically makes your kid go back to sleep. It sounds wonderful. Parents of babies are now finally sleeping through the night. It's super expensive. Own a couple of them and loan them out to the new babies. One of the biggest proposals I have, though, is for making stay-at-home mom jobs or stay-at-home dad jobs. When somebody gets married and is pregnant, start guiding them towards a job that lends itself to being done from home at your own schedule. For example, you know, an editor who's dealing with stuff with a longer lag time. That's the journalism example I think of. Somebody who processes payroll for outside vendors. That's the sort of thing that can be done remotely. Guide your moms or dads who want to stay at home and work fewer hours towards a job that lends itself to that. Build more of these new mom, new dad jobs.
What is the cure for parental loneliness and family isolation?
Community. This is absolutely one of the biggest stories of the last 30 years is our increasing isolation and alienation. And so the more that community institutions think, what can we do for new parents? What can we do for stay-at-home parents? Every church should be thinking of this, just realizing that some of the loneliest people are going to be people with a new baby. I remember our next door neighbors, when we had our first kid, they worried something horrible had happened because they didn't see us for 4 days, but really something amazing had happened. And we just didn't get any sleep and we had no ability to get out of the house. Eventually they came over and visited us and relieved us of some of the isolation of that. We were lucky that we had parents who came and visited us. So a stay-at-home mom can be really lonely, whether she's on her maternity leave or she's staying at home for 5 years. And communities, some are really good at this. Some communities will have mommy and me story time. A lot of churches do this, but not enough. Have a place, come, bring your kids. Either we all play with our kids together or we hand them off to the people who are going to look after the kids while the moms just have coffee and sit and talk. Or I say, if you're a county that wants to be progressive and promote gender equity, do more daddy and me stuff on a Friday afternoon. Encourage dad to stay home and do stuff with the kids together with other dads. That's exactly what we need. The happiest people are going to be parents who belong to communities. Often it's a church community, together with other parents.
Tim Carney is our guest, author of the new book, Family Unfriendly. We're talking about creating a family-friendly culture. What brought on the baby bust of the early 21st century?
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by purchasing a cell phone case from Crossway, crossweh.com/LPR. You'll find cell phone cases for Issues Etc., Lutheran Public Radio, The Word of the Lord Endures Forever, and Luther's Seal with the Reformation Solas. crossweh.com/LPR. A percentage of your purchase will support Issues Etc., crossweh.com/LPR.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
At Memoria Press, the Simply Classical curriculum is specifically designed for students with significant learning challenges. This complete program includes everything you need for a school, self-contained classroom, tutoring, or homeschool to make a classical Christian education accessible for any child. To learn more, visit us at simplyclassical.com and use the coupon code LPR24 at checkout. Simply Classical, a beautiful education for any child.
The way we as Christians view history is going to be different from how non-Christians view history. As a Christian, you already know what history is about, Jesus coming to save you. So wrote Molly Lackey in her inaugural article for Our Great Heritage, a new series at the Lutheran Witness online website on the history of the Lutheran Church and great historical figures in our history. To learn more, visit witness.lcms.org. The Lutheran Witness, helping you interpret the world from a Lutheran perspective.
Truth, beauty, goodness. You're listening to Issues Etc.
At the center of our campus is Kramer Chapel, and there's a reason for that.
Issues Etc. guest, Dr. Arthur Just.
Because it is the heartbeat of Concordia Theological Seminary. It is where we go to hear the voice of Jesus and frequently be fed with the body and blood of Christ. We sometimes call it our Jerusalem. Cramer Chapel points to the classroom, which we sometimes call Athens. It is there that we do theology, biblical studies, systematic theology, practical theology, history. We love theology here, and we love the study of it, and we love coming together in worship. It's one of the things that gives us great joy. Joy in worshiping, joy in studying theology. Concordia Theological Seminary is all about the joy of being in Jesus.
Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, ctsfw.edu. Folks, Easter greeting cards are a perfect opportunity to witness to family and loved ones. You'll find the best Easter greeting cards at adcrucem.com, adcrucem.com. We're talking about creating a family-friendly culture. Tim Carney is our guest. He's author of the new book, Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. Tim, there was a brief moment early in the 21st century, around 2005, when there seemed to be a glimmer of hope for fertility. It was appearing to be on the rise. What brought on the baby bust of the early 21st century?
Sure. So in 2006 and 2007, we hit record high numbers of births. And some people thought there was going to be a baby boom because the millennials were just entering, and they're a bigger generation, and they were just entering their prime childbearing years. But then, well, for one, the recession hit. After the recession, though, birth rates didn't rebound. So sometimes I think maybe we should point to something that started before the recession, which was the smartphone entered our culture and changed our culture. But both of those things, I think, helped start driving the birth rate down. And one of the things that happens in wealthy countries is when the birth rate starts to fall significantly below the replacement level of 2.1 babies per woman, then it spirals out of control, and it keeps spiraling down. So it might have been the recession, it might have been the iPhone, but in 2008, the number of babies started falling, and it fell every year after that.
What are the long-term effects of that baby bust?
So right now, America has fewer children than we did before, than we did at the last census. Not as a percentage of the population. The raw number of children, Americans under age 18, is on its way down. And the working age population has flatlined. So the economic long-term effects is that 20 years from now, we're going to have a shrinking working age population while we have a growing retirement age population. This will have all sorts of economic problems. Culturally, I think there'll be worse effects. One is that it will make people sadder. It'll make people think of the long term, the future, less. And it will make people think of kids less, which will then in turn make our culture less family friendly. So I think the long term effects of the baby bust are going to be economic turmoil. They're going to be sadness, going to be increasing strife, unless we can turn it around. And very few countries, basically no countries, have turned it around when they've fallen far enough below two babies.
Does the government have a role in encouraging larger families?
Absolutely, the government has a role. Local government should build infrastructure for families. Sidewalks, crosswalks, bike trails, playgrounds, etc. That will encourage families. That will make life easier. As far as the central government, the federal government, there is some role to make sure that we're not punishing families. A tax code without a child tax credit would be anti-family, would be discriminating against families. I think that accommodating families in the ways that life can be more difficult when you have a bunch of kids is, in fact, the role of the government. Right now, in fact, the government prohibits as discrimination some practices that a business might want to do to encourage families. If you tried to pay a breadwinner bump, give a raise to somebody who's the sole earner for their wife and kids, that would probably be discrimination. So the government in some ways has to get out of the way. They also have to get out of the way of allowing stuff like homes to be built. the starter home, which is what a lot of people need to go from their first apartment to their first home. There's so many regulations that block that. A lot of housing problems where the affordability really is an issue are caused by government regulation. And so getting out of the way, and every government, local, state, federal, should ask themselves, are we making it easier for people to raise kids? Especially because right now we have a falling birth rate while Americans still want two or three kids.
What about local churches? What can they do? Because this affects Christians as much as it does unbelievers.
So it's true that religious Americans have more children than non-religious Americans, but it's still low, barely above replacement, and generally it's falling. So the main thing to do is very clearly through your actions, through your rules, just broadcast, send the little children to me, send the little children to us. Religious schools should have, it used to be the norm for Catholic schools to say your second child is half off, your third child and on is free as far as the schools. And now they say, oh, well, it works into the financial aid application. I understand, but it should be in the letter of the law. And parish communities should, and local congregations should also make it clear, bring your kids on Sunday, every Sunday. I personally like to hear the screaming and the crying of the children. I know that not everybody does, but one of the sayings we have is if your congregation isn't crying, it's dying. But also, some parents will want to have a little creche, a little daycare during church. Providing that, just do whatever it takes. And there's multiple options for this. My friend Lyman Stone advocates that every, and I put this in the book, every congregation send a baby box to every new parent. So this is something that acts as a cradle, and it's packed with the basic needs. It's packed with the spiritual and religious needs. And every new parent should do that. And then I say, and every wealthy congregation should partner with a poorer one and make sure that these baby boxes are going out to the new moms in those localities. It really ought to be on the shoulders of these local religious congregations to say, we want you to have kids, and we're going to do these steps to encourage it and to make it normal. Another thing, and this is where Family and Friendly starts in the preface, is a T-ball league where the T-ball is just an excuse for families to get together, let the kids run wild. If you have a campus that has a playground and the kids can wander and all of that, use that. Every Friday night, have the whole family come out. If you don't have something going on, come out here. We'll feed you, throw $20 in the basket if you can afford it, and run free, because parents need a place to bring their kids and ignore them while they run around. And all of those things would emanate from a religious congregation saying, what can we do to encourage people to bring us as many kids as possible?
Why do you hold up Israel as something of a model?
So statistically, Israel is by far the most fecund, fertile, wealthy country. 3.0 is their birth rate. European average is 1.5. We're down below 1.7 in the US. Interestingly, while the religious obviously have more children than the secular, secular Jews in Israel have a birth rate of 2.0. So that means that they have built a culture that it emanates from religion, it emanates from the tribe, it emanates from their geopolitical situation. But even more broadly, they've built a culture that's family friendly. As one man put it, in Israel, the bus drivers have a real affection for little kids. When I was walking around, you know, 8 o'clock, 8:30 at night, it was perfectly normal to have children in the pizza places and in the sit-down restaurants. Children 7 and up are sitting down at these nice white tablecloth restaurants. They're not because they're all perfectly behaved, but because people come to understand it's normal to have kids and to have them everywhere. And so they have disseminated throughout the culture the norm of having kids. One very interesting detail about Israel, 70% of Israeli moms get help in raising kids from their own moms. Very few things predict having a second and a third and a fourth kid more than getting help from your immediate family. And in Israel, that's absolutely the norm. So they have established through just norms and customs and traditions, being family friendly is what we ought to do.
So talk a little bit more about what role religion plays in encouraging family formation.
So I do not think that the biggest impact of religion on encouraging family formation is the teachings. And with all respect to the pastors who write the great homilies and deliver them about this, I think that the real difference is going to be the values that inform the creation of community. So if you believe, send us more kids, and you act that way, and you create a tight-knit community where there's role models, slightly older parents. Oh, wait a second. They can have five. We can have five. Okay, you know what? There are minivans that seat six kids in the back two rows. Oh, there are what we call in our circles the Catholic assault vehicles, the hotel vans that are really 12 or 15 seaters. Okay, you can buy one of those and somebody will sell me their used one. Oh, look, these high school girls will be the babysitters for my kids. And then my kids will babysit their children when they have them. That these things that happen in the community, they really trickle out if the community makes it clear that they value children. And one of the reasons that this comes out of religious communities more than anybody else is an idea of, I am not the beginning and the end, that there's something bigger and that this generation is not the beginning and the end, that we are inheriting something valuable and passing down something valuable. And all of those things create a community that values children and then in very concrete ways supports families.
Tim Carney is our guest. We're talking about creating a family-friendly culture. We'll get into technology next.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the season of Lent at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the season of Lent, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod cares deeply for those who protect our nation. Are you or a loved one currently serving? Ministry to the Armed Forces would like to help. We provide devotional literature to encourage faith. Send your mailing address to lcmschaps@lcms.org or call us at 314-996-1337. Those in uniform are comforted with Psalm 28. The Lord is my strength and my shield. My heart trusts in Him and He helps me.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you continue in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free.
Dr. Russell Dawn, president of Concordia University, Chicago.
Indeed, the quest for truth is at the core of a university's purpose. The liberal arts, illuminated by the revealed truths of Scripture, are powerful for equipping students for a life of self-governance. A disciple is one who follows the Master. So what does it mean to follow Jesus? He said that it means to take up one's cross. The cross is thus the symbol of dying for others, of dying to self for the sake of serving others. And a life of service is a life well lived.
Truth, Freedom, Vocation. Concordia University, Chicago. CUChicago.edu.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Talking about creating a family-friendly culture with Timothy Carney, columnist for the Washington Examiner, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and author of the new book, Family Unfriendly. Tim, how has the smartphone in particular, and then our technology boom in general, affected the family?
There's the old saying that the medium is a message. And with the smartphone and social media, the message is an inherently isolating, alienating one. I think cultural inheritance, what you get from your ancestors and passed down, One thing to realize about that is that's unchosen. That's an unchosen obligation and an undeserved, unearned benefit. And the logic of an Instagram or a TikTok or a Twitter is that you're this person who's going to curate your life. You're going to write your life script on a blank page. And that's an inherently family unfriendly spirit and anthropology. And I think that the smartphone absolutely drives home that idea. And then you throw in the dating apps, and those create all sorts of dysfunctional cultural norms. You talk to 20-somethings or 30-somethings who say, well, it's considered inappropriate to ask out a friend of a friend. It's considered inappropriate to ask out anybody in person because you didn't go through the double secret consent process that is a dating app. So you end up with actually later marriage, you end up with less marriage, you end up with less relationship and less connection. And so that's obviously going to reduce the number of families that are forming.
Why are young adults less sexually active? This is something that has been showing up in research for about a decade now.
Yeah, we wouldn't have expected the sexual revolution to give us a sex recession, as some writers call it. But part of it is going to be the apps. Part of it will be these forces that discourage real relationships and partnering. Part of it is just the careerism that tells everybody they need to delay marriage. Later marriage leads to less sex in your life. Married people do actually have sex more than unmarried people, despite what some of the jokes may imply. But I think that there's certainly a lack of connection. What we regret and lament as a hookup culture on campus is not really about a total lack of restraint as much as it's a total lack of connection. And so a less connected society, less connected young people, is going to lead to later marriage and fewer relationships.
Is family-friendly feminism a possibility?
Absolutely. What I advocate in the book for family-friendly feminism is starts with understanding the natural and fundamental differences between men and women, biological, physiological, psychological, and then saying we need to make sure that we're building a world for mothers. A lot of the world as it is now has been shaped by men, and sometimes without enough concern for moms, for women. But a lot of it is also going to happen in the workplace. Nobel Prize winning economist Claudia Goldin, she said that the degree to which there's still a pay gap between men and women is almost entirely due to the fact that mothers demand more flexibility. So mothers are being compensated in flexibility instead of in pay. And so some people say, okay, well, we can fix that by just having free daycare. Moms won't demand flexibility. So that idea of feminism is like a workist, corporatist, careerist feminism that says, oh, well, the problem is that women should become company men. I make the opposite argument. Company men should become family guys. That an employer should be saying, hey, if your family needs you, go home. And ask yourself if your family needs you. That the workplace allies that women need are going to be men who stand up and say, hey, I got to go home. My family needs me. So that when the woman stands up and say, hey, I got to go home. My family needs me, she's not penalized for that. So a family-friendly feminism, one aspect of it will be a workplace that values family more and that extends flexibility to dads and moms alike so that when mom demands that flexibility, she doesn't get penalized for it.
In a lot of ways, you're really talking about redefining feminism altogether by casting it in that light, aren't you?
Yes, I'm acknowledging that women are naturally more family-oriented. And that dads will be family oriented in a different way, but that I guess I'm feminizing culture by trying to make us all be more family oriented. But it's certainly not about some symmetry in the world between men and women. So it's different than the modern feminism, but it does definitely have overlaps with older sorts of feminism, which was based on saying women are different and the world should not be built by men for men. It should be built for everybody.
Many believe, and the message is obviously reinforced constantly, by public institutions and the media that being a stay-at-home mom is simply impossible. How do you respond?
So first of all, that message is largely a broadcasting of values and priorities by an elite class that doesn't share the values and priorities of the American public. Most American parents, two-thirds, believe that the best way to care for kids is by one or both parents to reduce the amount of paid work they do and to instead stay at home with kids. I think if you ask the news media and academia, I think it would be one in 20 that actually hold that pro stay-at-home mom position. So we have a big divergence between our highly educated, career-oriented elite who set the message and the average American. But as far as then the next argument of, okay, I would like to have a stay-at-home wife or be a stay-at-home mom, but the economics just doesn't allow for it. That is certainly truer today than it was 6 years ago. This is part of what makes our culture family unfriendly. But it's not true that it's impossible. First of all, because work flexibility and more work from home does allow it, make it easier for women to make income while being at home with their children. But also, a lot of it just has to do with values and trade-offs and sacrifices. And so having one person stay at home is impossible if you think you need to give your kids the best of everything, which all costs $1,000 for a travel team, et cetera, a massive house, a nice car. But the economic sacrifice that you can make and the ways in which having one parent stay at home actually connects you better to the community and can reduce your costs. A lot of people don't understand that. They can't see to that side of the river until they cross over.
Suzanne Venker, who's written for decades now extensively in criticism of modern feminism, has a little aphorism that I think is very helpful, speaking to women, saying, you can have it all, but you just can't have it all at once. And she advocates for, if you want to have a career, delay your career rather than your kids, and seek your career when your kids are self-cleaning and able to drive themselves to school and things like that. What are your thoughts?
Absolutely. But again, I would say one thing to think about is starting even earlier. If you have a Christian school and some of the girls there at age 17 and 18 are starting to think, hey, I'd like to be a stay-at-home mom. What can I do? Develop work skills that can be dialed up and dialed down. In one sense, there's the nurse. If you're a nurse, there will always be infinite demand for you. And so if you want to work 10 hours a week, you can find a job that does that. I have a friend who's a school teacher and his wife is a nurse. And in the summer, she works a ton while he's home with the kids because it's summer vacation. He's a teacher. Otherwise, as a writer, I always think of the editors, a woman who edited the first draft of Family Unfriendly. She had her third kid while editing it, and she did everything on her pace. She said, I'll have this to you in 8 days, but there were no deadlines between the day she got it and the day she turned it back around to me, because she didn't know when her other kids were going to be napping or sick or anything like that. And so I would start it earlier, but absolutely, if you are a career maximalist, you can't stomach the idea of taking 10 or 15 years and having parenting be your main priority that takes up a vast majority of your time. But if you think, I want a family and I want a career, if you order it that way, it is possible.
Finally, what is the path toward more and larger families?
It's going to start with the bosses, the local policymakers, everybody just saying, okay, Americans want more families than they have. They want bigger families than they have. How do we do it? If that's a question that the city planner asks, that the employer asks, different policies will come out. Slightly deeper than that, it'll be a change and an embrace of sacrifice. It will be people saying, okay, you know what? My individual autonomy and my career plans, some of those are going to have to be set aside. And that's not the message that young people are receiving in high school and in college. They're receiving the opposite message. But then even deeper than that, I think, is we have to believe that we're good. I think that a huge part, what I call civilizational sadness, which is the last chapter in the book, I believe there's people who just don't think we're good, or we're only good if we have this certain measurable achievements. And so changing the anthropology will be necessary towards that, which frankly will probably require a religious resurgence. It's not crazy to say. I mean, I know we think that we're on a constant march towards secularization, but it's not crazy to imagine another great awakening that's happened in American history. And a great awakening is really the most important thing, where people say, okay, children are made in the image of God. Okay, sacrifice is valuable and is the path to happiness. Those would be the things that could really pave the path towards more and larger families.
Tim Carney is a married father of six children, a columnist at the Washington Examiner, senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, and author of the new book, Family Unfriendly: How Our Culture Made Raising Kids Much Harder Than It Needs to Be. You can purchase this new book at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Talk On Demand Archives. Tim, thank you again.
Thank you.
Thursday on Issues Etc., we'll have pastors Brian Wolfmiller and Brian Ketchelmeyer respond to your unanswered Bible questions, and we'll respond to your email and the Issues Etc. comment line. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
I am beautiful because I am fearfully and wonderfully made.
I am accepted because I'm a part of His family through Jesus' shed blood.
Unity Lutheran School in East St. Louis, Illinois, shines the light of Christ in one of the most impoverished cities in America. Learn how to support their mission work at unityesl.org. Unityesl.org.
Today, with the help of the Holy Spirit, I say yes to God in His ways.
The Lord has redeemed His people.
Listen to chapel services live, weekday mornings from Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Morning Chapel from Kramer Chapel. Live weekday mornings at 9 Central, 10 Eastern, 8 Mountain, and 7 Pacific at issuesetc.org.